I am Chuck C., the persecuted husband of your Al-Anon speaker. She forgot the punchline on that tale she was telling about the boys. Bill came in and says, "Mother, can't you be quiet?" He says, "We know what's wrong with you, with our father, but what the hell's wrong with you?" I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be, as far as that's concerned. I have no right to be any place. But I'm glad to be here. You're a great bunch of people. So far, this deal's been going all right. Thank you. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to spend the weekend with all the Alateens in Canada. North Battleford, Saskatchewan, Canada. And they had over 1,500 Alateens there from all the provinces in Canada. And it was a fantastic weekend. We had a lot of fun. You don't have to be 80 years old to, thank you. Let's try that again. You don't have to be 80 years old. Much better, much better. Thank you. to get some answers in Al-Anon and Alateen and AA. I didn't make a mistake in my first 43 years of life. I've got a little angel out here looking at me, and she just looked at me like I was telling the truth. But it's true. The first 43 years of my life, I always had somebody to blame. It was never my fault. Never. All the catastrophes and failures and drunks I ever had up until I was 43 were not my fault. They were your fault. They were conditions and circumstances. They were the so-called civilization in which I was born. The drinking deal had much to do with my wife. She was a pretty good reason for getting drunk. But she couldn't hold a candle to her mother. Her mother only had one kid, and I was married to her. And she lived with us for the last 5 years of my drinking, which were pretty bad. And she had a grandstand seat watching the crucify her only daughter. And she didn't like me very good. And I didn't like her that good. Because if she hadn't have been living with us, I wouldn't have had to crucify her daughter. We had a mutual hating society that was a beautiful thing to behold, really. Now, she lived with us 5 years after I got sober. And I wish that I didn't have anything to do tonight, but to tell you what this program did for her. That old bitty sure did change. And she never did go to the AA meeting. Never. But she really changed. And she would never believe that I'd gotten any help from anybody. You or God or the devil. She would not believe that I'd get, she'd come up and put her arms around me and pet me a little, and she'd say, "Oh, son, I always knew that you had it in you." Well, I know I had it in me, too, but it wasn't what she was talking about. But she would never believe that I'd gotten any help. Put her arms around me and tell me all these nice things, and I just blush from my shoe tops up because I knew from whence it came, but she wouldn't believe it. I had the good fortune in 1900 and, well, it started out the Friday before Christmas, 1945. Ended up after the middle of January, 1946. I had the good fortune in that period, which was 28 days, the best I can figure. Surrendered. Now, I wish the hell I could remember something about that period of time. Because if I could remember taking the first drink or the second drink or the middle drink or the last one, I'm pretty sure that I'm smart enough to figure out a way to take credit for the last 36 years of my life. But I can't remember anything that happened in that whole time. Nothing. My wife tells me that I did away with 7 quarts of whiskey every 3 days during that whole time, and I can't even argue with her because she was there and I wasn't. Furthermore, I don't think 7 quarts is too much for 3 days. If you only stay with it about 15 days. But if you stay with it 28 days, it's either just enough or too much. And in my case, I guess it was just enough. Because when I came to, probably the 17th or 18th of January, 1946, everything between me and me had burned out. All my excuses were gone. And all my I wants were gone. And I could see me for the first time in my life with nothing between me and me. And it wasn't really a very nice sight. I accepted the fact that morning that I'd lost the battle of life. First time in my entire life that I had admitted defeat. I could not admit defeat. I became a periodic 11 years before coming to this program because I wasn't going to lose to a bottle. And I had to get well enough to get back in the ring for the next round to prove that I wasn't going to lose to a bottle. And it took me 11 years to... It took it, whiskey, 11 years to kill me. But it did it. And so, for the first time in my life, I knew that I'd lost the battle of life. I didn't know why, because I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew the inside of jails. I knew convulsions. I knew the DTs. I knew dirty beds. But I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. But a thing happened that morning that I wish I could explain. My good wife had found Jack Alexander's article in the Saturday Evening Post, the March 1st issue in 1941 of the Saturday Evening Post, about us, about the budding Society of Alcoholics Anonymous. She had read the article and decided that it would do me some good if I would read it. So she put it open at the right page on the left arm of the chair I sit in right now. So that when I came in, if I came in, I might read it. And evidently I did. But I never remembered a thing about reading it until the morning I came to. And I remembered that I'd read it. And I only remembered two things about it. That drunks helped drunks and did not drink. And they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to me, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. And instantly, my little period of sanity was gone. And I was sickened to death, drunk, and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from the very second of commitment until right now, I have never had a drink of alcoholic beverage, a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind, and better yet, I have never had one conscious desire for drink. Now, when I had gotten to be a member of the Beverly Hills group, we lived in Beverly Hills at that time, every time I mentioned that I'd never had one conscious desire for drink, half of the group would hit the floor. And they would say to me, not very nicely, Chuck, you're a goddamn liar. And they thought that was right. You know? But I knew it wasn't. You see, the only white knuckle sobriety, or not sobriety, but dryness, that I've ever had, I had in that 11 years when I was fighting the bottle. I had a lot of white knuckle and not drinking then. It wasn't sobriety because I was never sober. But since I made my commitment until right now, I've never had a conscious desire for a drink. And I'm more grateful for that than that I haven't had one, because had I had a conscious desire to drink, I'm sure I'd have gotten drunk. I always did. So this is the reason I have been spending so much time in the last 36 years talking about this thing called surrender. Surrender! I'm convinced that this is the most misunderstood experience in human life. The very most difficult subject to talk about. In all the human subjects that you might talk about. Because the more learned you are, the more totally you believe that it's not normal not to be going someplace. It's not normal not to be trying to get something for yourself. It's not normal not to be trying to improve yourself. You know? These are normal things according to the learned. I can have my living room full of PhDs. That's double PhDs. Give me some coffee, will you? And all I have to do when I get a little sick of them is to ask them, gentlemen, did it ever occur to you what it would be like never to want nothing, no time for yourself? And their chins drop. And their eyes get glassy. And they look at me very, very strangely. Thank you, sir. And they fold up their little papers and silently steal away. You see, it's not normal not to be going someplace. So they realize that I flipped.
that I've suddenly become an imbecile. And there's no use to talk to an imbecile. So they take off. Now, I can understand it. They can't, but I can. And I can understand it because I never consciously surrendered. I was surrendered. Everything between me and me burned out. And I got here without it. Thank God. And I believe this to be the one thing that many amongst us are missing. And I can't very easily understand that, because I've been here now for 36 years without a drink or pill. And I've been attending lots of meetings. And I love it. I love this program and I love its people. Even you ugly monkeys right here at this table. I just love you. Love you to death. I was really talking to him back then. 20 years I've known that railroader. But it's really difficult. And the more learned, as I said, the more learned you are, the harder it is. But you see, I get calls all the time for people that have been from 15 to 25, sometimes 30 years around this program of ours. And they say to me, Chuck, how do you surrender? And I flip. You know, I flip. Because that's what our program's all about. That's exactly what this program is all about. For instance, just for the fun of it, the very first step in our program is a twofold admission of defeat. Twofold admission of defeat. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable by us. Now that's quite a start for an alk, isn't it? Total twofold admission of defeat in the first step. The second step's worse than the first. Because it is a left-handed admission that we're nutty as a fruitcake. It says, that we had come to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Now I submit to you that there is a implication here. Sane people don't need to be restored to sanity. If we need to be restored to sanity, we're nuts. And the third step's worse than both of them. Because it says we got to get a new driver. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, as we understood it. Why? A, that we're powerless over alcohol, can't run our own life. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. See that God can and will if we work with him. So, we make a decision to get out of the driver's seat, get ourselves in the driver. Now, this is not normal alcoholic behavior. Really didn't. I'm quite mindful of the many times when stopped me in a car that I owned and tried to make me get out of it. And I would tell them very definitely, this is my car. And I'm driving it. And I'm going to continue to drive it. And he says, oh, yes? Get out. I says, I'll get out when you cut me out. And when they got their knives out, I got out. We made a decision to get ourselves a new driver. And you monkeys keep calling me and saying, how do you surrender? If I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I am no longer my problem. Huh? What do you say, son? I'm his problem. I've turned me over to him, right? So, hey, how about that? I got an expert here. And yet, I get calls all the time. How do I surrender? How do I surrender? There's a lot of phrases like letting go absolutely. You know. All that kind of thing. And anyone know how do we surrender? That's number one. Number two, we have a great inclination in the Southland to do away completely with the ancient and honorable institution of marriage. All of our young people and some of the older ones have meaningful relationships. Now, I wouldn't find so much fault with them if they didn't get up in a meeting and tell us about God getting them a meaningful relationship. Now, I'm mindful of when I was younger. I might say quite a little bit younger. We call this monkey business sacking up. And if there's one guy in the world that we didn't want to find out about it, it was God. Is that right, sir? Yeah. We would go to any length to keep God from knowing anything about that, you know. And here they call me and say that God's taking away their meaningful relationship and they're mad at him. 5 days later, they call me and say they're double mad at him. Because he hasn't sent him a replacement. Now, as my arithmetic goes, that adds up to making God a pimp. And I don't believe God's a pimp. I really don't. And I keep wondering when we're going to come to again. Because I don't find anything in my book that would indicate that I am free to, you know, be a bed hopper. I don't find it. And I don't think it's something that adds to your life or mine. I do not. Some of these days, you and I have got to learn that love includes possession, but not the necessity to possess. The necessity to possess is ego. I want, I don't want, I like, I don't like, I yay. You know? And I have concluded totally that it is divinely impossible to satisfy the human ego. Divinely impossible. Because I think, perhaps, that the best definition of the human ego you'll ever hear is conscious separation. Conscious separation. And I also think that it's very easy for us to see, if we're looking for it, that there is no way that we can satisfy any obsessions of the mind. They cannot be satisfied because they're all relative. I rubbed shoulders in the last years that I was in the business world with some of the richest people in the country. And I had one chap that was worth $35 million. He was a Syrian. He'd gone from one head of lettuce to $35 million. And he would say to me, "Charlie, how can I be like you? I didn't have $35 million. How can I be like you?" And I'd say, "Eddie, you can't." And he'd say, "Why can't I?" I'd say, "Eddie, who needs God when he's got $35 million? You can buy anything you want, including women, and you do. Because Eddie was a Syrian. And the Syrians think they're God's gift to women. And I suspect they might be. But I would say to Eddie, "Now, Eddie, you go ahead and make yourself $150 million. And when you have $150 million, you come to me and say, 'Charlie, how can I be like you?' And I'll tell you, and you can do it. Because by that time you will have discovered that there isn't enough money to do for you inside what you have to have done. Can't be done." I'm going to give you one more little instance, because these things are most important to me. This is what it's all about. I might stop for a second before I do this and tell you that there's only one reason I'm not drunk tonight. Just one. There are not two reasons, there's just one. And the reason that I'm not drunk right now is because I've got the thing I was looking for in the bottle. I've got it. Now, what is the thing? It's the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with myself. Do you hear me? And when I can live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with me, I don't have a bit of trouble living with you. Not a bit. It's a fantastic thing. There's nothing in a bottle, needle, pill, pot, or acid that can do anything to me but tear me down. So it's not necessary in my life. So, the thing that is quite necessary with us, whether we be alcoholics or not, is to see that the problems we're having are not particularly booze problems or gambling problems or food problems. I have a great joy in dealing with the Fatties Anonymous down in my country. Boy, they hate my guts. They try to correct me every time I speak of them, because they want me to say Overeaters Anonymous. I says, that don't do it for me. Fatties Anonymous. But that isn't a food problem. It's a living problem. We're trying to compensate for something we're short on, you see? And it won't compensate. There is no way to satisfy the human ego, because it's all relative. For instance, let us say that I had been the greatest Lothario of all times, and every chick that I ever saw that was looked good, that I took out after I caught, but one. Now at my age, that'd be quite an army, wouldn't it? Huh? Would that army satisfy me? No, this one kills me. The one I can't get. Kills me dead. My obsession is power. We all went through Watergate. Everybody in this country was damaged by Watergate. Not one person was benefited by that scene. Everybody was damaged by Watergate. Biggest power struggle that's ever happened in this country. For nothing, really. What about, we've already spoken of money. It's impossible. Satisfy an obsession for money. There isn't enough, because again, that's all relative. When you got 35 million, Eddie's partner in the oil business had 150 million. And they had the finest suite in the Jonathan Club down in Los Angeles, which is the best club for men in town. And I've gone in there many times, and Eddie'd be shining his partner's boots, because he's got $150 million. You know, it's a funny deal. No possibility of satisfied obsession for money. Supposing that it's whiskey. As if it weren't. Now, I live up on the hill in Goonie Beach. And I look right down on top of that little town and the Pacific Ocean. Catalina Island, that C talked about a little this morning. It's a beautiful, beautiful spot. Most beautiful view in the world, I think, because it's forever changing. You never see it twice the same. And, of course, there's the Pacific Ocean, and that's the biggest puddle there is. And when I look out my window without even thinking, everything in me announces. My toenails and my hair announce that if the whole Pacific Ocean were bourbon whiskey, it wouldn't be enough to satisfy my obsession to drink. Hear me? It cannot be done. It's impossible to satisfy the human ego. So it's a matter of necessity that we get rid of it. And suppose you get here not surrendered, as I did. The first 9 steps of the program are there to surrender us. And they will surrender us if we do them. You know, it says there at the beginning of chapter 5, here are the steps we took. It does not say, here are the steps we thunk. You know, it don't say that. It says, here are the steps we took. We took them and something happens. We don't took them and nothing happens. And it's that simple. And they are there, and they outline exactly the way that we can obtain and maintain our own sobriety and be rid of. You know, Bill himself says, if we have been painstaking in these matters, we discover that we have been relieved of the bondage of self. And that's what we need to be relieved of, the human ego. Because it's impossible to satisfy. Totally impossible. Now I'm taking too much time and I'm going to quit. Because you monkeys have got to listen to me a little bit in the morning if you come. Now you don't have to come. Because I've already giving you the pearl of great price. Ha, ha, ha. Yeet. Get out of your own way. That's what I've been saying. Get rid of the human ego. Now, the things that I'm going to tell you now, I don't say because somebody said them. Because everybody has said these things that I'm going to talk about. Probably the most, the simplest one, the whole bunch, was the man that petted the birds. What was his name? Tell me. St. Francis. St. Francis says, better to love than to be loved. You know. It's better to understand than to be understood. For it is in giving that we receive, in forgiving that we're forgiven. And in dying to self or surrender that we awaken to eternal life. Now, if the rest of you don't know it, the Padre knows that I changed that last line. I change everything that don't fit. When I was quite young, I changed the line in the Lord's Prayer. Because I knew, even when I was that high, that God couldn't lead me into temptation. And there was a thing, lead us not into temptation. And I didn't like it, so I changed it. To thou leadest us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. and I like that, and I still say it that way to myself. I say it with you like you say it. But to myself, I say it that way. Thou leadest us not into temptation, but delivereth us from evil. Now, when I got affluent enough to buy a New Testament that was a direct translation from Aramaic, which was the tongue of Jesus, I was reading it, and you know what it said in there? Thou leadest us not into temptation, but delivereth us from evil. I said, had that pretty good, didn't I? And I say in St. Francis's, because he says it's in dying that we awaken to eternal life, and I didn't want to wait till I died. So I says, what do you mean? And I came up with this. Actually, he meant dying to self or surrender that we awaken to eternal life. And I thought, well, I mustn't go out here and tell these Catholics, because if there's one thing we got running out of our ears, it's Catholics. And Alcoholics Anonymous. So I said, I got to get some authority. So I knew the whole pack out at Manresa. We've got a Jesuit retreat house called Manresa out by Azusa in the valley. And we've been going out there for years to retreats for alcoholic men and alcoholic women and alcoholic couples and everything else. And it's a pretty nice place to spend the weekend. So I know all the padres out there, and I called them, and I says, I got a hold of old Father Toner with the big belly. A sweet guy. Oh, God, he's a sweet guy. And I says, Father, listen to what I did to St. Francis of prayer. For it is in dying to self or surrender that we awaken to eternal life. And you know what that monkey said to me?
He said, what the hell do you think he meant?
Hell, he never even thought of it till I told him. And I also changed my 11th step. When I wake up in the morning, this is my 11th. Look, Dad, I'm reporting for duty. Now I'm going to move it around. I'm going to do the best I can with what I got today. And all I want out of you is a little guidance and direction and power to carry it out. Sure, thank you. And I go about my business. And I do what's indicated. And I don't have any trouble at all. I just do what's indicated. I don't wait till the wind whispers in my ear or something else. I just do what's indicated. And life is good. Now what's happened to me? I'm a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk. And I haven't had a drink for 36 years. And in 36 years, I haven't tried to get anything for myself. Nothing. I haven't tried to go anyplace. No place at all. I haven't had anything to prove. I haven't had anybody to impress. And since I quit doing those things, everything that I'd been trying to bring about for 43 years and ended up without. 43 years, I gave it everything I had. I gave it my very best shot, and I ended up a failure in every department of life. Husband, father, businessman, man, and drunk. At 43. And here I quit trying to get anything and got rich. I mean, beyond any of my expectations. Got rich! That's what I did. Quit trying to go anyplace. Been all over the world. Quit trying to run my life and my wife's life and our kids' life, and we've become a family. Now I'll finish up. You didn't think of it would, did you, son? These people up here close to me are pretty comfortable. I might as well go ahead and talk all night. Don't encourage me. You know, I have come to believe something that is not too well thought of amongst the religious. I've come to believe that it's my business to go about God's business, and it's His business to take care of me. And that is not my business. And this is the way it came about. When I was 6 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I discovered that I had a God of my very own, and wherever I am, He is. Now, this is something I'd been trying to bring about all my life. A comfortable experience with my very own God. And I hadn't accomplished it. And when I came to you people, I came to find out how not to drink today. Not to get sober and stay sober, but how not to drink today. Because I didn't want my wife and kids to remember me as nothing but a babbling idiot. I knew I was going to die imminently, but I didn't want to die with a record. I needed to be sober so I could use whatever time I had left to rub out as much of the record as I could. And that's the reason I found you people. And the very first night, you told me what was the matter with me. I'm not going through it. Because I got to sit down. But I knew that the gentlemen that were talking to me were drunks, because they were marked up like I was. They had headlights here. They had bags under bags. Their wiring was exposed. Because at that time, AA was only 5 years old on the Pacific Coast. And they hadn't had time to lose those markings, and neither had I. So I looked at them, and I knew they were drunks. And I knew they weren't drunk, because I heard their voices and saw their eyes. And it was comfortable there. It was comfortable. And I was back every night. Because it was comfortable. Now, I knew that I couldn't have what you had. This one didn't even bother me, because I didn't have enough left to get it. And secondly, it wasn't necessary, because I wasn't going to live that long. Nobody could live in the condition I was in. So I was going to die imminently. But such time as I had left, I must use rubbing out the record. And at 6 years, I discovered I had a God of my very own. Wherever I am, He is. Very beautiful, beautiful experience. And I was so tickled because I'd tried so hard to bring it about and missed that I said to myself, how can I show my gratitude? And with this I quit. The first thing I decided to do was make him a plaque, because we were in the woodworking business. Some of the finest woodworkers in the world. We got them mainly out of the Mideast. And they were excellent. They could do anything with wood and formica and stainless steel and things like that. So I was going to make him a plaque. And I had it half designed in my mind when I said to myself, who are you going to give it to? And I could see me handing that plaque to God, and He didn't take it. And I dropped it on my foot and broke my foot. So I had to laugh at that. And then I was back at the starting gate again. What are you going to do to show your gratitude? This time I decided to be a Trappist monk. I read a lot about the Trappist monk. I thought they had a pretty good life. So I'm going to be a Trappist monk. And I'm pretty comfortable with that until I said, wait a minute. It's not very easy to get into Trappist monks if you're not Catholic. And that I ain't. So I had to give that one up. And then I said to me, how am I going to show my gratitude? Back at the starting gate again. And this is what came out of it. I remembered a little episode between the carpenter man and Peter before the carpenter man left. He called old Pete in. You call him St. Peter. I call him old Pete because we were boys together. And before he got to be a saint, I identified with him quite a little. You remember when he got caught with the goods in the beginning, he lied out of it. Well, that was one of my great proclivities. Lie it out of it. So I identified with him up to a point. So, Pete evidently was a favorite of the carpenters, too. Because he called him in and he says, Peter, do you love me? Peter says, yeah, Lord. He says, tend my sheep. I turned right around and said to him again, Peter, do you love me? Yeah, Lord. Tend my sheep. And then he turned right around and asked him again, Peter, do you love me? Yeah, Lord. Tend my sheep. Now he said, tend my sheep. If you're not Catholic, if you're Catholic, it's tend my lambs. But I said to me, he must have meant tend my sheep. He said it three times. So I embarked on that deal, and that's all I've done. For 36 years, that's all I've done. That's why I'm here. Two reasons I came to see you. To tell you, number one, quit thinking. That's what got you here. Quit thinking. You can live yourself in the right thinking, but you can't think yourself in the right living. So start doing something. Get rid of that thinking, Ben. And the second thing I came to tell you is to love you. And you don't have to change nothing. You don't have to change anything for me to love you, because I know who you are, whether you do or not. If one of us is God's kid, all of us are. If one of us isn't, none of us are. Is. And I am so you is, so quit worrying. And so, when you and I get simple enough to go about our Father's business because we want to, just because we want to, for free and for fun because we love it, we come to see that underneath are the everlasting arms. And all of the things that the good book speaks about. Like, try me, saith the Lord, and see if I don't open up the windows of heaven and pour out a blessing on you, which is so great you can't even receive it. Like, fear not, a little flock, it's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. Like, take no thought of the morrow, what you'll eat, what you'll drink, or wherewithal you shall be clothed. Your heavenly Father knoweth what you have need of before you ask him. We prove in our very own livingness that all of these things mean what they say. And we're home free. And this is the great, great good fortune that we get as a bonus, because we run out of our own resources and we do these things for sobriety only. Just how can I live today without this curse? And we discover that it includes all the rest of these things. How fortunate can we be? I'm so grateful I can't see. And again, I love you to death. God bless you. Thank you very much.